KPFT-CAR. Thanks for your help. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, KPFT.org worldwide.
Beautiful music by Marcel Khalifa. I'm going to tell you about it a whole lot more shortly. Good evening, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Today on the show, we will speak with Andrew Basevich, Professor Emeritus of International Relations and History at Boston University, a retired United States Army colonel, and New York Times best-selling author. His latest book is titled, and it's just released, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. We will speak live with Professor Basevich about his new book, U.S. Wars in the Middle East, U.S. presidential candidates and their stance on wars, U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East, the military-industrial complex, U.S.-Israel relations, and much more. We will also take your questions live. The phone number is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. But first, let's start with Arab Voices Community Calendar. This station, KPFT, will be hosting Amy Goodman and Dennis Monihan, authors of the new book, Democracy Now! 20 Years of Covering the Moments Changing America. It will be a book signing event to be held this coming Sunday, May 1st, at the Carl Walker Jr. Multipurpose Center on 4300 Noble Street, and it will be held at 1 p.m. Admission is $10 per person. Advanced tickets are available online at kpft.org. There will also be a meet and greet before the main event, lasting from 12 noon to 12:50 p.m. at the Deluxe Theater on Lyons Avenue. Spaces are very limited. Make sure to get your tickets today at kpft.org. This important new book looks back over the past two decades of Democracy Now! And the power, movements, and charismatic leaders who are reshaping our world. Goodman takes the reader along as she goes to where the silence is, bringing out voices from the streets of Ferguson to Staten Island, Wall Street, South Carolina, to East Timor, and other places where people are rising up to demand justice. Democracy Now! Is the modern-day underground railroad of information, bringing stories from the grassroots to a global audience. So come and meet Amy Goodman and Dennis Monihan this coming Sunday, May 1st at 1 p.m. at the Carl Walker Jr. Multipurpose Center on 4300 Noble Street. All the details are listed online at kpft.org. The Palestinian American Council in Houston will hold an event titled Palestinian Cause, Challenges, and Prospects, and that will be held next Wednesday. The guest speaker will be Dr. Ahmed Taibi, member of the Israeli Knesset and head of the Arab Movement for Change Party. This event will be held on Wednesday, May 4th at 7:30 p.m., at the Arab American Cultural and Community Center on 10555 Stancliff Road. For more information, visit pac-usa.org. The National Arab American Medical Association Houston chapter will hold its 10th Biennial Bin Qurra Award Gala, honoring distinguished Arab Americans in the fields of medicine and life sciences on May 7th. There will be many honorees at the gala this year. The Scientific Achievement Award 2016 National Honoree will be Dr. Huda Aqil, and the Houston honoree will be Dr. Hashim Sarraj. The Lifetime Achievement Award recipient will be Dr. Samir Tuma of Houston. The Humanitarian Award will be given to Dr. Osama Jaber and Dr. Lillian Jaber. The Leadership in Education Award will be given to Dr. Kamal Khalil. The Innovation Award will be given to Dr. Rabih Darwish. The Spirit of Naama Award will be given to Dr. Muhammad Ali, Dr. Hussam Bahrani, Dr. Samia Khalil, and Dr. Nizar Shobasi. This National Arab American Medical Association 10th Biennial Ben Qurra Award Gala will be held on May 7th at 7 p.m. at the Hilton Houston Post Oak on 2001 Post Oak Boulevard. Congratulations to all the honorees. And by the way, proceeds from the 10th Ben Qurra Award Gala will go toward the National Arab American Medical Association Houston Chapter Scholarship Fund and Charitable and Humanitarian Work. For more information, visit aama-houston.org. Maxine Kaufman Locusta, a Quaker Jewish activist and writer from Burnaby, Canada, will be in Houston to speak and do a presentation on nonviolence in Palestine. She will share information about nonviolent activism by Palestinians and Israelis, separately and together, in challenging the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land, as this is a much under-publicized aspect of the Palestinian struggle, as well as ways in which internationals can support these efforts. She will also introduce her book, Refusing to Be Enemies, Palestinian and Israeli Nonviolent Resistance to the Israeli Occupation. The book is an interview-based study that presents a voice or voices of over 100 practitioners and theorists of nonviolence, the vast majority either Palestinian or Israeli, as they reflect on their own involvement in nonviolent resistance and speak about the nonviolent strategies and tactics employed by Palestinian and Israeli organizations toward the occupation. This event will be held on May 9th at 7 p.m. at the Live Oak Friends Meeting Place on 1318 West 26th Street. For more information, visit refusingtobeenemiesthebook.wordpress.com. The 10th Annual Houston Palestine Film Festival will be held this year, May 13th through May 28th. It will be a celebration of 10 years of Palestinian cinema in Houston. There will be 10 nights full of drama, comedy, adventure, and history on the big screen, and will take place at the Museum of Fine Arts Houston and at Rice University Media Center. This year, Houston Palestine Film Festival will also have an exciting panel discussion on independent filmmaking. There will be special question and answer sessions and receptions with film directors. For a full list of all the movies that will be shown, visit hpff.org. The Islamic Circle of North America Houston will hold its ICNA Relief Annual Benefit Dinner for the Needy and Humanitarian Aid on May 14th. It is planned to be an inspirational night of empowerment and learn how to advance the lives of refugees and other needy families right here in Houston. There will be three speakers at the event, Sheikh Yassin Sheikh, Sister Dunya Shuhaib, and Houston's very own Imam Shah. This event will be held on May 14th at 7 p.m. at the Arab American Cultural and Community Center on 10555 Stancliff Road. For more information, visit icnahouston.org. And on May 15th, the Moroccan Society of Houston will hold a spring picnic, and that will be at Sugarland Lost Creek Park. More information about that, as well as many other events scheduled in the greater Houston area, is listed on our website, and that's arabvoices.net. We update that on a regular basis. We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we will speak live with Andrew Besevich, Professor Emeritus of International Relations and History at Boston University. He's a retired U.S. Army colonel and New York Times best-selling author. His latest book, just released, is titled America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. We will speak with him about his new book. We will talk about U.S. wars in the Middle East, U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East, U.S. presidential candidates and their stance on wars. We will also talk about the military-industrial complex, U.S.-Israel relations, and much more. We will take your questions live. The phone number is 713-526-5738. But I mentioned at the top of the hour the music that I played. This is the first time I play that music. This is from a brand new album for world-renowned Lebanese composer and oud master Marcel Khalifa. It is called Andalusia of Love, Andalus al-Hub, entirely based on Mahmoud Darwish's love poem Yatir al-Hamam, Pigeons Fly. In this new album, Marcel pays tribute to Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish, who passed away in 2008, right here in Houston. In this album, Marcel Khalifa, by the way, we've had on this show live before, Marcel Khalifa, because he has been to Houston several times. In this album, Marcel evokes memories of the late Mahmoud Darwish, presenting a work that combines poetic creativity and beautiful music. The new album, Andalusia of Love, features a long poem written by the late Darwish and sung by Khalifa as he plays the oud. Marcel Khalifa describes his new album as, quote, stemming from a life lived in fear, death, killing, destruction, and ugliness. And from among all this, Andalusia emerges. Here, love is not merely words like most songs, but rather involves real suffering. And hence, I was compelled to delve deeply into love as a human experience and break away from the traditional formats of Oriental music and song and come up with a more personal musical work, unquote. So this new album is published by the Nagam Records label. I'd like to thank Mustafa Habib for sending me this new album, again, just released a few weeks ago. For more information on this new release and all of Marcel Khalifa's work, visit his website, and that's marcelkhalifa.com. That's MarcelKhalife.com. We will have a link to that on our website. So let's listen in to another track from this Andalusia of Love new album for Marcel Khalifa before we speak with our guest.
تستريح
was Lebanese composer and oud master Marcel Khalifa from his new album Andalus Al-Hub, Andalusia of Love. Welcome back to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Joining us now live via phone from Massachusetts is Andrew Basevich. He is Professor Emeritus of International Relations and History at Boston University, a retired United States Army colonel, and New York Times best-selling author. He's a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, and he served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the U.S. Army. He received his Ph.D. in American Diplomatic History from Princeton University, and he also taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins Universities. Basevich has authored several books and publications. His latest book, released earlier this month, is titled America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. He has numerous other books that he has published. His essays and reviews have appeared in a variety of scholarly and general interest publications, and his op-eds have also appeared in several online and print newspapers. In 2004, he was a Berlin Prize Fellow at the American Academy in Berlin. Professor Basevich, welcome to Arab Voices.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks. We appreciate your time this evening. It's good to have you on the show. We'd like to begin, if you could tell our listeners more about this book, the latest book that you have authored and just released a few weeks ago, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Obviously, you have a wealth of knowledge and experience over the years in U.S. wars and their U.S. interventions in the Middle East and so on. What drove you to write this book and tell us more general information about it?
Well, the book is a history. It's a military history. It describes U.S. military involvement in large parts of the Islamic world dating from 1980. I didn't begin my story in 1980 because that's the year that President Jimmy Carter promulgated what came to be called the Carter Doctrine. The Carter Doctrine identified the Persian Gulf as a vital U.S. national security interest, meaning a place that the United States was now willing to fight for. I think most of us have forgotten that prior to 1980, the Middle East was not a place that the United States was willing to fight for. Prior to that time, it was willing to fight for Western Europe. It was willing to fight and had fought in places in East Asia. So beginning in 1980, that changed. The result, I think unanticipated result from Carter's point of view, was to initiate the militarization of U.S. policy in large parts of the Islamic world, leading to what has come to be a very, very long list of interventions, large and small, brief and protracted, each of which was intended by policymakers to, and I'm using a Washington term now, to somehow shape the greater Middle East. But here we are, 3.5 decades after this project began. We have not shaped the greater Middle East. We have not won the war that we initiated. We are not winning it. And the real point of the book, the bottom line of the book, is to invite readers to take stock of this military enterprise and to suggest that maybe it's time for the United States to try a different approach.
On the way you described it, the Carter Doctrine, why did Carter at that time decide to intervene and to start fighting in the Middle East?
Well, I mean, and I would emphasize, President Carter is probably the least bellicose president we've had in the past half century, and he by no means, in my view, understood exactly what it was he was touching off. But to your question, the impetus for the Carter Doctrine was both international and domestic. Internationally, in 1979, that is to say the year before the Carter Doctrine, The Iranian Revolution had occurred. The hostage crisis had begun. In December of 1979, the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, and the perception in Washington was that events in the Persian Gulf threatened U.S. access to Persian Gulf oil. This at a time when the American way of life was seemingly dependent upon access to foreign oil. So that was the international part. I think the domestic part was that in 1980 was, of course, a presidential election year. At the beginning of 1980, Carter's chances of being reelected appeared to be not good. The economy was ailing. There was a perception that he was weak on foreign policy. And so by drawing this line in the sand, as it were, Carter was trying to look tough, hoping to improve his chances for re-election.
Now, and obviously Carter is gone, and we had so many presidents after him, Bush and Reagan and Bush and Bush the father, Bush the son. We've had also Clinton. We've had Obama. Now Obama. But they all seem to be continuing with wars in the Middle East,
You're making a tremendously important point, mm-hmm. and that is that it is not as if this has been a partisan project. Indeed, it's been a bipartisan project. Every president since Carter has been committed to this war for the greater Middle East. They didn't use the term, but every president since Carter has undertaken armed interventions in the Islamic world of one kind or another, and again, in my judgment at least, without achieving any notable success, and indeed, in some respects, when we look at the conditions that exist today, having made matters worse, despite the enormous costs paid by the American people and the enormous costs imposed on people in the region.
So who keeps driving the United States to continue with these wars or even create wars? Is it the military-industrial complex?
I think that's that is an explanation, but I think it's a lesser part of the explanation. I mean, you are correct, I think, in noting that the enormous national security apparatus that the U.S. has developed since World War II, is committed to a world view that assumes that order depends upon the assertion of American leadership, and American leadership is defined in military terms. But I do think that there is an additional explanation, and I suspect it's a more important explanation, and that is this, that events in the Islamic world, in particular, events in and around the Persian Gulf, but also events as far away as Central Asia, have seemed to call into question the verdict of the 20th century. Most Americans think of the 20th century as the American century. That is to say that the historical events of the 20th century elevated the United States to a position of primacy that was our birthright. And so now events in the 70s and 80s and 90s and since 9/11 have seemed to suggest that maybe the American century either was a fiction or maybe the American century has ended, and that therefore the United States is really not the so-called indispensable nation. And many Americans in Washington are unwilling to accept the possibility that we are a nation that has limits, that we are not unique, that we are not called upon by history to somehow bring the world to some providentially designated institution. all of that is exceedingly difficult for Americans to swallow. So I think in that sense, the war for the greater Middle East has been a war to sustain the idea of American exceptionalism.
You know, you mentioned 9/11, and of course we know what happened after that with the fabricated war on Iraq. It was a horrific destruction of the country. So many people killed, over a million people killed, estimated in Iraq. Many U.S. soldiers were killed. Your son was one of them, Andrew Besevich Jr. He was an army officer, and he died fighting in Iraq in 2007. This war has cost the United States tremendous, not just financially, as we mentioned, but human side and so on. Iraq is unspeakable acts that took place in Iraq. One thing that keeps bothering me, and I'm yet to understand it, is that, Army General, retired Army General Wesley Clark, whom I'm sure you know, he one time in an interview, he was talking about how that war on Iraq started. He was puzzled at why we were even going to war in Iraq, and then talking about other countries are on a plan to be invaded or to be had by the United States. I would like you to listen to that. It's only a few seconds, what he said in that interview, and then I'd like to get your feedback on that as we talk about this U.S. military actions in the Middle East and so on. This is retired Army General Wesley Clark a few years ago in an interview.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the Joint Staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No." He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, no. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They've just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
That was Army General, retired Army General Wesley Clark, puzzled even himself and other generals in the U.S. military about decisions made planning to go to wars in some countries and they don't even know why. Is that how decisions are made or how the U.S. Army works? Or?
Well, I mean, I don't know how decisions are made. I mean, I would say this, that I wouldn't put a lot of confidence in the specifics of General Clark's anecdote. That said, in a more general sense, I think that he was speaking a great truth. And let me explain. When in the aftermath of 9/11, in this moment of shock and anger and fear, my judgment is that the inner circle of the Bush administration, and we're talking here about probably not more than a half dozen or a dozen people, the people who really wielded influence with the president, that they concocted a strategy of sorts. My book says that we had already been at war in the greater Middle East for 2 decades. But it was an aimless war. After 9/11, the George W. Bush administration came up with a concept about how to win the war. But the concept was utterly bizarre and unrealistic, And it was this, that a demonstration of the implacable power of the American military in overthrowing a government and bringing about a fundamental political reorientation of that nation would serve as a demonstration of American will and power that would then subsequently influence the behavior of other nations in the region. And the small number of decision makers identified Iraq as the target, as the place to teach this lesson. And my point is that we invaded Iraq not because Iraq was dangerous and posed a great threat, but actually we invaded Iraq in 2003 because Iraq was weak and vulnerable. The Bush administration expected that the campaign in Iraq would lead to a very rapid, very decisive, relatively cost-free victory, and they expected that in the wake of that victory, the political transformation of Iraq would occur in short order. Now, let's you and I imagine, just for the sake of argument, that that had happened. Let us imagine that when President Bush made his famous landing on the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln and declared mission accomplished, let us imagine that the mission had indeed been accomplished. Where would the United States have been in the summer of 2003, vis-a-vis those countries that General Clark was ticking off in his anecdote? We would have been in a position, it wouldn't have been necessary to invade those other countries. We would have been in a position, in a sense, to dictate to other countries how they should rearrange their affairs and reorient their policies. So it is true, as Clark suggested, it's true in my view at least, that the Iraq War was intended to lead to something much bigger. It was merely a way station. That the real aim was to transform the entire region. And of course, what occurred was that instead of a victory quickly won at small cost, what the United States ended up with was a long, drawn out, painfully costly, unsuccessful war. And my point in emphasizing that is that in Iraq, this grandiose strategy of transformation collapsed. And although our war in the greater Middle East, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Somalia, in Sudan, has continued since then, It has continued without any semblance of a strategy.
And some, for many years, also argue, or they make a point that the United States went to war in Iraq for oil. One time I had Ray McGovern on this show live. He served as a former CIA analyst for some 27 years. And he himself said that he thinks the U.S. went to war with Iraq for oil, O-I-L, he said. O for oil, I for Israel, L for logistics. What's your take on this theory and the oil?
I disagree. Mm-hmm. I mean, my argument is that when the war for the greater Middle East began in 1980, yes, absolutely, oil was a precipitating factor because at that point, the American perception was that our way of life was dependent upon our ability to import foreign oil, to include oil from the Persian Gulf. But my argument is that, as I suggested earlier, fairly quickly the motives morphed into something far broader than that. And I mean, let us note that today in 2016, guess what? We don't need Persian Gulf oil to sustain the American way of life. There's plenty of oil, natural gas, here in the Western Hemisphere. And yet the war for the greater Middle East continues. And again, I think it continues. Oil cannot be an explanation for why it continues. But rather, I think the explanation is this blind determination to reject the evidence that is right in front of us, that militarily this entire enterprise has been futile, and to refute the evidence that the United States, as powerful as it is, at the end of the day is just one more nation like every other nation, that it is a war to sustain our claims to American exceptionalism.
Yeah. And we want to talk more about accountability for those who are involved in these wars in the Middle East, in the United States. We want to talk about ISIS and Syria, the U.S. presidential candidates and their stance and their comments about the U.S. foreign policy and wars. But I have so many callers already on hold, so I want to take some of their questions. Our guest this evening is Andrew Bezifich, Professor Emeritus of International Relations and History at Boston University, a retired U.S. Army colonel and New York Times best-selling author. His latest book, just released, is titled America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. The phone number to call is 713-526-5738. 713-526-5738. Let's take a call. First one is Tim, and then we will go to Gary. Tim, you're on there.
Hi, Mr. Bezifich. I just wanted to let you know I appreciate your tireless work and your truth-telling to the American people. Thank you so much.
Alrighty, thanks, Tim. Do you have a question or just wanted to say that comment? Alrighty. We'll move next to Gary. Gary, you're on the air.
Hello, I have a question for your guest. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're looking at the macro level of political engagement, but, you know, it's kind of like if our Congress decided to pass a law against hurricanes because they caused so much damage, it really wouldn't do much. Are we not just missing the whole point here by ignoring the sectarian and religious divisions that are causing this? It's not just because we invaded Iraq or the problems going on in between Iran and Saudi Arabia. We're kind of missing the point, aren't we? I mean, these people have been fighting for 1,000 years, and, you know, America is going to fix everything? It seems a little silly.
Well, I certainly agree that it's silly to think that America is going to fix everything. And I think the caller makes a very good point. And the point is that the disorder in the greater Middle East has a multiplicity of causes. Sadly, the United States has contributed to the disorder through its ill-advised policies, but it certainly would be wrong to say that everything that goes wrong in the Islamic world is somehow a direct result of U.S. policy. The root causes are several. One of the points I'm making in the book is that, first of all, U.S. policymakers, dating back to 1980, were largely oblivious to those multiplicity of causes and naively assumed that the assertion of American military power could somehow fix things. Events have demonstrated that's just not going to happen. It seems to me that we have now arrived at a point where it ought to be possible for us to acknowledge that our military efforts are not going to succeed. We're not going to shape the greater Middle East, and therefore the imperative is to have a discussion of policy which in acknowledging that military failure, begins to consider alternatives. Sadly, even in a presidential election year, the discussion of any possible alternatives is all but absent.
You know, when he mentioned the sectarianism and fightings for so long and so on in the Middle East, really, if you look at the Middle East, there is no doubt that there are dictators in power there, several Arab countries. That's a known fact, non-democratic and all that stuff. And people there have been yearning for peace and democracy and justice and all kinds of good stuff that they want for their lives. But really, when we look over the years, there has been no sectarian divisions. You look in Iraq, you look in Syria, and so on. We've never heard until recently, over the last several years, Shia against Sunnis or Sunnis against Sunnis or the so-called ISIS, this Islamic, they call themselves Islamic State. That's nothing but a terrorist organization. Nobody has heard of them. And all we hear and we see in the news is that a lot of those people are really paid from outsiders to wreak havoc in the Middle East. Some even blame the West. You know, there's a lot of theories out there. What's your take on all of that? We've never heard of Shiites against Sunnis and Sunnis
I am not a scholar of Islam, and so I hesitate to make any judgments about that. It does seem to me, at least at the present moment, there's significant hostility between different components, mm-hmm. parts, of the Muslim community in the region. But I would want to emphasize that I don't conclude from that somehow this is a problem that somehow can be simply laid on to Islam itself. Clearly, European colonialism is a contributing factor to the dysfunction of the region. Clearly, the absence of genuine economic development that meets the basic needs of populations is a factor. Clearly, the absence of enlightened local leadership, people who genuinely are committed to the well-being of the population, that's a problem. Clearly, the misguided U.S. military efforts is a factor. Clearly, a problem stemming from the creation of Israel is a factor. So I think it's a mistake to somehow identify one causal factor and say, aha, this is what explains why there is this disorder in the region.
Interesting point. Let's take another question, and that's from Kevin. Kevin, you're on there.
Hey, how you doing? I think it's my area of inquirement is where y'all are at right now regarding the busting up of the Ottoman Empire and why this is recent, you know, meaning we didn't have the radical Islam or these factions that Arab against Arab until recently, or, you know, Sunni against Shiite, whatever. I think, you know, the dividing up of the Ottoman Empire into these satellite nations at the was the last throw of the British Empire to divide and conquer this Ottoman Empire into these satellite nations, and then come back later on to bust them up again with what's called as Arab Spring. I think Zbigniew Brzezinski mentioned it in the Grand Chessboard that whoever owns, you know, Central Asia, well, you know, the breadbasket of the world, will, I think, this is a staged effort, and since U.S. is the imperial force for this whatever reason, these, you know, just dividing up in these like colored revolutions that we're witnessing right now.
Yeah.
So okay, I was wondering if that it sort of correlates to, you know, who's funding, you know, ISIS and the creation of these factions and who funds them. I know who they are, but I'll let the guests.
Alrighty, thanks, Kevin, for that call. Professor Bisevic.
Well, I mean, I largely agree. I think there is no question. The modern Middle East, what we think of as the Middle East, is a creation of European imperialists, particularly the British, who acted to advance imperial ambitions. They acted without any concern for the well-being of local populations. And then when the Europeans, after World War II, got tired of the game and withdrew, sadly, the United States inherited their handiwork, and we've been trying to deal with it ever since. So that is certainly a contributing factor. I'm repeating myself, but I would only want to emphasize that, from my point of view, there is no one explanation for the disorder that is a concern today.
What is your take on what's happening in Syria and with this ISIS group, the so-called Islamic State, which is really an un-Islamic based on its actions and what it does there? It's nothing less than a terrorist, horrific organization that's wreaking havoc in Syria and in Iraq also. Obama mentioned a few days ago that he'll be sending 200-plus troops now to on the ground in Syria. There have been bombings from there by various countries. So many external factors, so many countries from the Gulf, Western, Turkey, and so on, involved in Syria. Some call it a proxy war between other countries. What's your take on what's happening there?
Well, my take is that, first of all, and this is very important, that ISIS would not exist had the United States not invaded Iraq back in 2003. This is part of the poisonous fruit of that reckless and ill-advised war. I don't expect that people like George W. Bush are ever going to acknowledge that, but American citizens should own up to the fact that, to a very large extent, we created this problem. My own sense is that ISIS poses a very limited threat to the United States. I mean, this is an organization that probably consists of, 25, 30,000 fighters? They have no air force. They have no navy. They have no significant power projection capabilities. They have no serious resource base. They have no allies. So I don't think that we in the United States need to be quivering in our beds about the prospect of an ISIS attack. I do believe that ISIS poses something like an existential threat to nations in the region, too. Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and therefore it's incumbent upon nations in the region who differ with one another in many respects, it's incumbent upon them to recognize that they are facing a common threat of transcendent importance. And were they to collaborate with one another against ISIS, I believe that they could defeat ISIS. I think that the diplomatic challenge facing the United States is to persuade Iran and Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Turkey to set aside their differences in order to focus on this immediate threat. And I'm not trying to say that that's easy to get them to set aside those differences, but let us recall in World War II that a Soviet Union committed to Marxism-Leninism, a Great Britain committed to basically white supremacist colonialism, and the United States committed to a form of liberal democratic capitalism, all found ways to collaborate in face of the common threat posed by Nazi Germany. So such collaborations can occur, and I think it should occur in this case, in part, and this is from a self-interested U.S. point of view, in part to let the United States begin to withdraw militarily from the region.
Okay, we have about 4 minutes left or less. I want to ask you about your feedback on what we are witnessing with the presidential candidates here in the United States in terms of the U.S. foreign policy. Their blind, unbelievable support for the state of Israel. Every time I hear them talk about foreign policy, I would think these are running for the president of the United States of Israel, not for the United States of America, maybe except one or two, like Sanders, who spoke something a few days ago on CNN that was shocking to a lot of people out there. You mentioned earlier at the beginning of this program, we talked about that this is nonpartisan, that these wars will continue. It's beyond a Democrat or Republican and so on. What's your take on what we are witnessing now with the stance by Cruz and Trump and Clinton and Sanders and Kasich and others about the U.S. foreign policy and their interventions and their blind support for a country like Israel that uses arms and weapons supplied by the U.S. in violation of the United States Arms Control Export Act?
Well, I regret the fact that, and you're right to point out Senator Sanders as somebody who stands apart in this regard, but at the present moment, it appears that Senator Sanders' candidacy is not going to succeed. So, yes, those who remain in the race are all fully committed to the standard rhetoric about the U.S.-Israeli relationship. What I regret is that no one in the race is willing to acknowledge the extent to which the interests of the United States and the interests of the State of Israel do not align. I mean, from an Israeli perspective, I get it. I mean, I get it from an Israeli perspective that the idea of creating a sovereign Palestinian state poses a great risk. And were I an Israeli Jew, I probably would oppose a two-state solution. But as an American, I believe that the United States has a profound interest in promoting a two-state solution, in responding to the grievances of the Palestinian people. And I think it's pernicious and counterproductive to pretend that U.S. and Israeli interests align when, in fact, they do not. So we need more honesty and candor, and we're not likely to have it.
In the minute left, in 1 minute or so left for this program, what should the United States do? How should its foreign policy change? How should it end this militarization of all of its acts almost in the Middle East and through many other countries? They've got hundreds of military bases all over the world that's costing us unbelievable things.
Well, I mean, one thing is to be realistic about our interests and about our and the threats we face. We don't need Middle Eastern oil anymore. The so-called terrorism poses a limited threat to the United States. U.S. interests in Asia are far more important with regard to American security and prosperity and freedom than are U.S. interests in the Islamic world. We need to demilitarize U.S. policy in the Islamic world, and we need to find ways to get nations in the region to take the primary responsibility for restoring order. Why? Because our efforts to restore order using American military power have, for the most part, simply incited greater disorder. This is a counterproductive policy.
Very well. We're going to have to leave it at this. Andrew Bezevich, Professor Emeritus of International Relations and History at Boston University, a retired U.S. Army colonel and New York Times best-selling author. His latest book, just released, is titled America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Thank you, Professor, so much. We greatly appreciate your time this evening.
Thank you.
Thanks. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening, and many thanks to Dima for her assistance. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Technology Bites is coming up next, and until we meet next Wednesday, peace on earth.
KPFT invites you to a celebration of the acclaimed program Democracy Now! And the extraordinary movements and heroes who have moved our country forward. So join us for a visit by Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! On Sunday, May 1st at 1 p.m. Amy Goodman will speak in Houston at the Carl Walker Jr. Multi-Service Center, located at 4300 Noble Street. Visit kpft.org or our Facebook event page for full details. You're encouraged to purchase tickets early because this event is expected to be at capacity. So visit kpft.org for tickets. Proceeds from this visit by Amy Goodman benefit KPFT Houston.
Help KPFT day or night, every time you shop. Your grocery store's loyalty card can be associated with KPFT, and you can support the station anytime you buy at no additional cost to you. At Kroger, bring the barcode printed on your member packet from kpft.org, then scan it along with your Kroger Plus card each time you go to the register. You'll be donating to KPFT every time you shop. At Randall's, simply visit customer service to link your Randall's Remarkable card to KPFT's organization number 4931. That's 4931. 1% of your purchase will go to 31. That's 4931. 1% of your purchase will go